Okay. So I imagine, like many parts of the world, tonight at Easter, instead of going out to have a dinner somewhere, meet your friends, or do any religious activities, or what you usually call religious activities, most of you are staying at home. That's what we're all supposed to do, to help with the problems of COVID at this particular time, COVID-19, to stay at home. And of course I did not follow that today, because moved from Serpentine to here, so I can give the talk live streamed. We don't have those facilities yet at Bodhinyana Monastery. We try and keep it very simple there. Sometimes too simple. But nevertheless, there were so few cars on the road today. And it kind of reminded me of those early years when I first came to Western Australia. It's almost 37 years ago now. When I first came to this country and started building the monastery in which I now live, Serpentine Buddhist Monastery. It was on the long weekends, like a Christmas or on Easter time. I would sit in the upper story of a very small A-frame hut, which I built myself. I would sit in the upper story, which just fat my size. Of course it just fat, because I built the thing to suit me. And I sat up there on this particular case, a Thursday or a Friday evening. And on a Thursday evening I would look and see the highway, which led from Perth down to the southern part of Western Australia. And I'd look at that highway and see all of the car headlights facing south. And I would just sit and just watch them, one after the other, hundreds of cars all going south. And then 2 or 3 days later, I'd watch a whole stream of cars all coming back again. And I thought, what are you doing? You're going away to get away from it all, but then you take everything with you, including your family, the kids, the problems, the arguments. And you go down and see all the other people who have left Perth for the holiday time, and then you all come back again. And I was just sitting in my heart, just watching it, not going anywhere, just staying perfectly still. Because it wasn't that I didn't have the means to go travelling. I just didn't want to go travelling. I was happy just to stay put, to stay home. And it started me wondering, thinking, why is it that people always want to go somewhere else? They always want to travel. They want to leave here and go somewhere else. What's wrong with here? In fact, because I had a very good training from a great monk, great teacher like Ajahn Chah, to see the beauty where one is. It's never perfect, there's always things wrong. It's a little hot, a little cold, a little wet if you're in Thailand, a little too many mosquitoes or whatever. There's always some faults. But in order to have this beautiful sense of contentment being where you are, I could actually see the beautiful things in the monastery in which I lived. And of course, many people, especially those who live in Western Australia, those people who from overseas come and visit for a retreat or just for a little holiday, and they come and see Bodhinyana Monastery, where I have lived for such a long time, they always regard it as a very beautiful monastery. And of course it is. The weird thing is, that sometimes people show me their photographs. You go overseas and they say, hey, here's a photograph. And I have a look and say, where's that? And they say, that's where you live, Ajahn Brahm. Oh yeah, that's true. Because the photograph only has a snapshot, only a part of the whole of what is called Bodhinyana Monastery. But to see the complete of it, to actually to be there, to feel it, to smell it, to feel the wind, to actually to listen to the sound of the place. All of that is something so amazing. So I'm actually happy to stay home. And it starts to ask the question, why is it that people... I rang up some gentleman today and I said, how are you? And he said, I'm bored. I'm bored because he has to stay home. And it made me start to think, I said, what are you bored for? You spend so much time, so much money building your house, renovating it, cleaning it, buying this to put in there, buying really comfortable beds and TVs and nice cookers and all the food you like. For years you've been paying off all those loans, you've got a nice garden in the back. Why are you bored? And you see that that boredom is not really logical or reasonable to me. Why is it that people have lost the art of recognizing the beauty, the tranquility of their own home? So much so that in ordinary times, when it comes to a big four-day holiday like Easter, people would jump at leaving. Where shall we go next Easter? Where shall we spend the time? Go down south, go down north, go overseas, go... You're only going crazy. I always notice if you stay home, you don't need a passport to stay home. You don't need visas. You don't need to book your aircraft and just wait in the airport hour after hour until the flight takes off. You're not cramped in tight seats. You're not eating food which is you don't really like. You don't have to queue up for the toilets and you're waiting and waiting and waiting and waiting because there's only a few toilets in those economy class. And sometimes you wonder, why do I do that? Because in your own home, you never have to queue up for the toilet, I hope. You never need to be squashed in a seat, maybe with a cat. You never need to carry suitcases when you go from downstairs to upstairs and upstairs to downstairs. It is so easy and comfortable. But why is it that we cannot appreciate the beauty, the comfort, the delight of our own home? Why is it the first opportunity we want to leave? It's because we're just looking in the wrong place. And after a while, this is a story, I think I wrote this story in Opening the Door of Your Heart. It's a story I don't tell that often, about the person who took my advice years and years and years ago. I decided to get away from the madding crowd, as they say, and stay home during the holiday period. Because everyone else was going away. Stay away from the congestion of airports, and the congestion on the roads, and the congestion of queuing up for your hotel or whatever it is, whenever you get to wherever you want to go. They decided to do something different and stay at home. So what did they do? They just sat in their garden. But they made a big mistake. Because when they sat in their garden, they had a book and they had one of those old radios before the time of the internet. So you're not in the garden anymore. You're in your book. Or you're in the radio. Or you're in the music. Put all of those distractions away. And even just calling them distractions was a very beautiful word. So put them away. And have a look at your garden. And so, they put all those things away and they just sat on a nice chair and looked at their garden. And then they started thinking, oh my goodness, those flowers need more water. That bush really does need a prune. That tree, look, you know, it's falling over. I have to get someone in there just to lop it or just trim it or even take it away. So that is not sitting in your garden. That's being another manager, trying to control things. So instead, sit in that chair and say, even though the path needs sweeping, even though the flower beds need watering, even though the hedge needs trimming, even though there's so much which needs to be done, not now. Let's offer appreciating your garden as it is, right now, instead of trying to feel, think, contemplate and plan how you are going to make it better. And what happens is something quite strange. It's unexpected, because once you start not thinking about how to make your garden look nicer, look better, look more attractive, you start to appreciate it for how it already is, your garden starts to look more and more beautiful. You start to have more appreciation of just some of the ragged looks which your garden has. Your garden is not a botanical park run by some government. Your garden is totally unique. A mess sometimes, but a beautiful mess, like nature always is, when we can leave it alone for a while. And there's some sort of harmony and beauty which comes in nature when you sometimes just leave it alone and let it organize itself. Now, I can't resist the sort of accompanying story, which is one which I read such a long time ago, just when I was a lay Buddhist. Because when I was a lay Buddhist, I didn't have the luxury of being able to choose what type of Buddhism I would follow. There were so few teachers, so few books, so few monasteries and temples, that any monastery or temple or book which had a B in the front for Buddhist, I would read or go to and check out. But anyway, this was a Zen story. And the Zen stories are wonderful simply because they're relevant, simple, not theoretical, to the point, and they always carry a wonderful message. And that was, it comes to my mind because some of the monks and communities I know in Japan, one of them gave me a call just a few days ago to make sure that everything was okay in Bodhinyana Monastery. But anyway, after asking how I was, I just remembered that story of one of these famous Zen gardens in a monastery somewhere in Japan. And it was one of these gardens which was just almost breathtaking in its balance, in its beauty, and just in the way that everything fat together in a natural, but even more than natural, very refined, beautiful Japanese garden. And so there was an old meditation monk. Now, whenever there's an old meditation monk, you know that whatever's going to happen next, the old meditation monk always comes out best in these stories. So don't ever mess with old meditating monks. I'm getting quite old now. But anyway, this old meditation monk heard about this amazing Japanese garden, so he decided to go and check it out. But if you're going to check out any of these great gardens, you don't just wait until the opening hours, you don't just read the books, you don't even ask the guides about these gardens. You've got to go and check what's really happening, what's happening underneath the scenes, so you understand how these things work. So this old monk arrived really early in the morning at this Japanese garden, climbed over the the gates, went inside and hid behind a bush, waiting for the head gardener to come out. And the head gardener himself was a monk, but a very youngish monk, maybe about 30 or 40. But obviously, this young monk had had a lot of training in gardening and also in meditation. Because this young monk came out with two wicker baskets. And as he went to the main area of the garden, which surrounded a beautiful plum tree, he picked up all the leaves and the twigs and any other rubbish which had fell from the trees the night before. But before putting it into one of the wicker baskets, he examined it first of all. And if it was beautiful, and only he knew its shape, its colour, and the way it twisted around, or the way the leaf was changing in colour halfway, he would actually put it in one basket, and the leaves, the twigs, which were really unusable, because they weren't beautiful, he'd put in a rubbish basket. He'd pick up the leaves and the twigs, not sweeping them, but picking up by hand, one by one. It took him a couple of hours. And he'd take the basket of rubbish leaves and put them on the compost pile. And then he'd have a cup of tea and then meditate. And once he came out of his meditation, he took the wicker basket with the beautiful twigs and leaves and placed them manually, one by one, around the plum tree in the middle of the Japanese garden. Sometimes he would put them out and look back and say, no, that's not right. And just twist it around a few degrees until he smiled. That was beautiful. There are some people who have that, or mastery you might call it, of shape and colour and how all of those beautiful parts of nature interact together. And this monk was one of those, because after he had finished, that garden was just breathtaking. It was beautiful, which was why only afterwards in the afternoon would he open it up for visitors, and everybody would just be in awe at the amazing garden this monk had created, except for the old monk. Because throughout the whole morning, the old monk was sitting quietly, unnoticed, behind a bush, watching every part of how this most beautiful Japanese garden in the whole country was constructed. And so after the young monk had finished, the old monk came out from behind the bush and went up to the young monk. And the young monk was surprised to see him, but the old monk smiled and put the young monk at ease and said, I've been watching you all morning. Your effort, your mindfulness, your control of colour and shape and is amazing. I've never seen anything like this. Your garden is almost perfect. Now that word, just that single word, almost, before perfect, was just like striking this young gardening monk with a dagger to the heart. He fell to his knees, and he put his hands up to the senior old monk and begged him, Master, Master, you've been sent here by the gods or by the Buddha himself. Please, tell me how I can make my garden not almost perfect, but perfect. I only want the best, and almost perfect is not good enough. And the old monk looked at this young monk, suffering, kneeling, begging in front of him. He said, do you really want to know? Yes, please instruct me, said the young monk. Really? Yes, I've been waiting for you for such a long time. Oh, please, great master, don't keep your wisdom and kindness to yourself. Share it with me so I can share it with others. Okay, said the old monk. And the old monk strode right into the middle of the perfect garden, or what that young monk thought was almost a perfect garden, strode right into the middle of the garden. And even though he was an old monk, he was very tough and strong. He put his arms around the old plum tree, and he shook the hell out of that plum tree. Shook it backwards and forwards, and twigs and fruit and leaves fell all over the place. And the young monk was aghast. He was shocked.
He was totally upset as well. You've ruined all my morning's work. Look at that garden, it's a mess. And the old monk looked at that garden and said, it's not a mess. Now your garden is perfect. And I always remember that story. I never tell that to my young monks when I ask them to do some gardening or to do some sweeping or to do any other cleaning work in our monastery, like washing the dishes. But anyway, because sometimes they get a bit tired and they say, you haven't finished in the garden yet. I said, oh yeah, that's good enough. It's perfect. Remind me of those stories. But the point of that story is that sometimes nature has a beauty, has a perfection, and has a quality of completion which can allow us to take a rest and find some peace in our world. That nature, with all of its degradation, faults, even today, you know, sicknesses and dying, all of those disruptions, sometimes, if you look wisely enough, there's even something beautiful in that. At least there is the opportunity to say, now it's beautiful enough, I can take a rest. Now my garden is gorgeous, so I can sit here just looking at it, enjoying its peace, enjoying its perfection, enjoying nature as it really is. And if you can see that beauty and truth and Dhamma in nature, sometimes even in some places the word Dhamma is translated as nature, but see it as beautiful, then actually you can just sit in that chair and just watch the garden for hours, seeing more and more beauty, just in the bush, in the tree, in the little piece of bark just falling off the tree, not fully fallen off yet, just hanging off. You see so much joy in that, so much beauty, when the mind becomes still. But you can go in your house and just sit, if you do want to get an old book, good old classic you've read before, but you're not doing it to escape, you're doing it to be here, to be with the people you love, your wife, your husband, your kids, your parents, and you can see more in them than you've ever seen before, see beauty in them. Sometimes that people tell me they don't really know who they married even. This is their wife, their husband, but they're so busy. Sometimes people are busy just paying off the bills, doing their work, getting up in the morning, getting themselves ready to go to work, going to the office, coming back again, and just life is so busy. They never actually even get to know each other. And it's a simile of the old ships passing. They never actually meet and stay with one another. And then they have children and just working with that. And sometimes people go through whole lives never really understanding one another or even understanding themselves. So sometimes when you have lockdowns, abilities, you have to stay at home. Who are you staying at home with? And sometimes you get to know one another. People have told me, I do look at the internet and see the news of what's happening during this time, say, oh, there's so much terrible domestic violence. And it's just unacceptable. It's really rotten if you're in the middle of that. But where does it all come from? Even no child abuse. You've got these beautiful children, this beautiful man, beautiful woman. And I've mentioned this before, that sometimes when people do ask me about why do couples, they fall in love and they get married, why can't they stick together? And sometimes I've been a monk for over 45 years now, and so I look at them I've known you a long time, you're a really good person, you're a really good guy. And look at the girl, you're just a beautiful woman. Why can't you live together in peace and harmony? And I must admit, sometimes I just don't get it. Why you don't sort of appreciate the good qualities in one another. But that's what I've trained myself to do for such a long time. See the beautiful qualities in all these people. Yeah, I miss you when I teach in an open hall with no one here. I can imagine all the people, just close my eyes on a Friday night, all the usual people who are sitting here. You've been sitting here for such a long time. I miss, you know, the question from Eddie at the end. But these are beautiful people, good friends, and I know their wonderful qualities. And I've seen those for such a long time. And you're not here today. But nevertheless, having known you, thank you so much for being friends, for being supporters, for just being here. And so when I see that beauty in people, I don't know why people can't live together. So, when you are by yourselves and you can't go off traveling or on holiday anywhere, you're at home, in your building, with a garden in the back, I hope. If not, just an apartment. You've got a balcony. You just go sit in that balcony and just watch the stars at night together. Or just sit facing each other and get to know one another more and more. Because what happens when you start seeing things you respect in a garden? You see more beautiful things. If you start seeing faults and mistakes, you see more of them. So which one do you really want to cultivate? When you other people see, I did this little exercise, oh, second year as a monk, oh, such a long time ago. Having spent 3 months together, a range retreat, this was in a monastery in central Thailand, with one of the other monks, and so with many monks, but this was one English monk, he was also from England, he was from the north of England somewhere. So anyway, we had a cup of tea at the finish of the rains retreat, and he decided, he said, well, Ajahn Brahm, what do you really think of me? Be honest. You know, you've seen me 3 months. And I said, okay, I will tell you what I think of you if you will tell me what you think of me. And so we compared our perceptions of one another. It was just monks. And anyway, his perception of me was nothing like I expected at all. It was totally just stunning what he said of me. It was very positive. And what I said of him was even more positive. He couldn't believe it. You're just making that up, aren't you, Ajahn Brahm? No, this is how I look at you. This is how I think of you. With a very positive mind. Maybe it's because of our training or the talks we hear, the books we read, the meditation which we do, just our lifestyle. We've always been looking at the beautiful things in life and the positive aspects of each other and also the beauty inside ourselves. And because of that, we saw each other as very wonderful, kind beings. And I thought after that it would be wonderful if, say, husbands and wives could do things like that, look at one another, and just look at the beautiful things in one another. Just like look at the most beautiful things in the garden. You don't need to be perfect to be beautiful. In fact, perfection is something very dry. Very dry, dead, dull. It's when people, you know, say that the path is really well swept. Yeah, put a few leaves on there, make it natural. Or the paving is a bit bumpy. Of course it is, because the world is bumpy. You know, the world is not flat. I don't believe in a flat earth. It's bumpy, it's round. And even like sometimes truths, people want a perfect truth. So you find the truth and it explains everything. That's not what the truth is supposed to do. The truth is supposed to be a little bit bumpy. Applies here, doesn't apply there. You have to twist it around here, twist it around there. No, who's right and who's wrong? You think in a family, just husband, wife, one of them must be right, one of them must be wrong. Why? Why can't you both be wrong? Or both be right and see totally different things?
Oh, what was that nice little Buddhist simile of the monks arguing. This was not good monks, obviously. And the monks were arguing, and please don't criticise me for touching my face. I did wash my hands before the talk. It's COVID rules. And I'm a long way away from anywhere. Some of you criticise you on the other side of the world, so I cannot infect you, okay? You can't send COVID virus genes or whatever it is over the internet, I think. I don't know. But anyway, I know you can't. But anyway, these two monks having an argument about reincarnation. Yeah, the Buddha taught reincarnation. You have to believe in reincarnation. You have to have trust and faith that the Buddha taught reincarnation. Otherwise, you're not real Buddhist. And the other one said, what are you talking about, reincarnation? You don't know that until you're dead. You've got to live in the present moment. You're not dead yet. So live in the present moment. We don't know. They had an argument. So how can you settle arguments when you're, you know, monks, especially junior monks? You go to see the teacher. So they went to see this wise old monk teacher, one at a time. And the first one went in there and he said to the teacher, yeah, the Buddha taught reincarnation. It's a fact. It's in every, you know, the Buddha remembered his past lives. And he can't sort of deny it. It's part of Buddhism. And the old monk said, yes, yeah, actually you're right. And the first monk went out very self-satisfied and proud. The master confirmed my view. You're wrong. You're an idiot. You should apologize to me. So I said, no, I'm not going to do that. So the second monk went in to see the great master. And he said, well, you know, we can't prove anything of the future. You know, it may be just all supposition. It may be true, it may be not true. But all we have is the present moment, just now. That's all there is. Present moment awareness, just now. And the old monk said, yeah, you've got a point there, you know. Yeah, that's quite right. And so the second monk went out self-satisfied, said, see, I explained it properly. And the monk said, I was right. He couldn't have done. He said, I was right. No, he said, I was right. That's impossible because I'm right. So this time, they went to see the old monk together. So the two of them went in there and they repeated what they said. And he said, you first said I was right. And now you said that he was right. We can't both be right. And the old monk said, yeah, that's right. And that was the end of the argument. I like that idea. Two people being right, or two people being wrong. It doesn't have to be one or the other. So it's a great end to arguments. You can't be right because I've been proved that I'm right. But I've been proved that I'm right. So you're both right, even having different ideas. End of problem. So I like that idea of getting to know one another without any fear. Because human beings are both, on all human beings, we've all got faults in us. I've got faults in me. I've been showing my faults for the last, how many years I've been here? 36, 37 years. Showing my faults every Friday night, whatever I'm doing. You know, touching my eyes. I'm not supposed to do that. Scratching my nose. Scratching my ear holes or whatever. So yeah, you have your faults. You know that having faults and not hiding them makes you kind of lovable. An example of that, you know that it's Thai New Year on the 13th, on Wed Monday, so my thoughts are sort of with the Thais. I have to do all these ceremonies at home because can't come to the temple. Oh, you know, if there was, we were in the temple, this place would be packed. You know, really sort of packed for the Thai New Year. It's in Thailand. A lot of fun, a lot of joy, a lot of happiness, but there's no way to have any social distancing, so you have to cancel it. Maybe do a big one next year or something, I don't know. But anyway, just thinking of, you know, the Thai people, and just, when I was in Thailand as a monk, when I came to Perth 36, 37 years ago, and I'd been in Thailand for 9 years as a monk. And my, honestly, no exaggeration, my Thai language skills was very, very good. Writing Thai, reading Thai, and speaking Thai, and even translating many times. Ajahn Chah asked me to translate for him. And many times I was invited to give talks by myself in Thai, you know, because I could give good talks in Thai. But coming here, I hadn't really used my Thai language that much, and so it's rusted so much that my Thai is a little bit, it's a bit strange. People who know me a lot, when I speak Thai, they can understand me, but if they've never heard me before, they can't understand a word I'm saying. Just like that time, a group of people came from Thailand, there were about 60 or 70 of them, and they asked me, said, please, no, we can't understand English that well. You're a monk, you've been in Thailand. Can you please give us a talk in Thai? Just Thai, nothing else. And I'm usually very kind and open, sometimes much too kind. So I said, yes, okay. So I gave this group of 60 Thai people, just come for 10 days I think, come all the way to Perth. And it was in the old community hall just next door. And I gave them a talk in Thai for about 20 minutes, half an hour, about that time slot. And afterwards they were so happy, sadhu, 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 it's wonderful. They said, wow, you liked it? I said, yes. That's the first time we've ever heard a Western monk give a talk in Pali. Pali is the language of the sutras. It's a dialect of Sanskrit. And I said, I never talked in Sanskrit, I talked in Thai. Oh, we don't understand what you were saying, so we thought it was in Pali. Oh, that made me feel all that effort for nothing. It was an effort for nothing, because I had a nice story I could tell people afterwards about the embarrassing things which I've done in my life. But when I was in Thailand, it was excellent Thai. And sometimes all the Thai people who support us here, and you see them especially on the big occasions, and I asked them many years ago, I said, should I go and do some lessons to brush up my Thai language skills? And they said a very clear no. So why not? They can understand me more. They said, no. We like the Thai that you already speak because it makes us laugh. Thank you so much. They say it was lovable. It was just, you know, it was who I am. Ajahn Brahm says silly things in Thai sometimes. And that lovability, that sort of naturalness, that just, oh, this is our monk who can speak Thai sometimes, but not all the time. And that just makes you lovable, attractive. Just like the bent and twisted trees are the most beautiful. Just like the dust or the clouds in the sky at night make the most beautiful sunsets. It's all that not having to be perfect. So when you're with your partner at this time, and you're stuck together in your home, or in an apartment somewhere, please, they're not perfect. The one you've chosen to live with, now you're actually living with them. You chose this. Now you're with them. Just see how imperfect your wife is, and how imperfect you are. How imperfect your husband is, and how that makes you lovable. Be honest, be upfront. You're a human being. A human being is growing in this world. Just like the tree, like the plant, like the rose bush in the garden. It's growing. You're learning. And you learn together, not by being perfect, by opening up your faults, your weaknesses, your parts of you which are vulnerable. You have a partner who can understand your vulnerabilities because he or she has got pretty much the same.
What is it you want in life? You just need to be understood and respected, to be loved, not to be perfect. And we match each other. Human beings match so well. If you want to have a perfect partner, then just what one person told me years ago, if you want a real perfect partner, somebody who's always there for you, who can always listen to you, or sometimes speak to you, who's always can entertain you, but can be quiet when you want them to be quiet, then get a TV. Or if you want someone who's just always happy to see you, then get a dog. Don't get a husband or wife, because they will never fulfill that. That's nature. Instead, when we are with one another, we learn what a husband, what a wife is, what a partner is, who we are. That's the other great thing about when you're at home. It changes the nature of what home actually means. When you're at home, you're with the people who for some reason or another karma has given you. Even in a prison, you have people there that some people you fear, some people become very, very close friends. But especially at this time, if you're in a little room, if you're in a house, an apartment, you're stuck with your kids, your grandma or whoever else is there. These are the people which karma has given you to learn from, to grow with, and be kind to. And if we can, learn how to be kind to one another, learn how to give to one another, learn how to take time out by just going in your room and even just having a rest or something, but always being kind and gentle towards one another. How you would like to be treated. Please treat your mother, your father, your brother, your sister like that. Treat them as you would like. If that doesn't work for you, treat them as Ajahn Brahm would like. Respectfully, kindly, forgivingly, never looking at people's mistakes and faults, except to laugh and have some merriment. But look at people's wonderful qualities, all the incredible sacrifice which people do. If you can do that, it's so easy to have a wonderful family. And you have a few days off, a few weeks off, a few months off, I don't know. But you can have a wonderful time together. Really get to know one another, learn from one another. And of course, what you learn from your partner and from the other people you live with in life, you also learn about yourself. Other people are just like mirrors through which you can look inside your own heart and understand how you work. And if your heart is understood, if your heart is not fixed, but embraced and respected, and your path in life is also trusted to be something which is sometimes painful and disappointing, that is part of life. You can't escape from disappointment and pain and hurt. That's part of life. Of course, I got that from all that stuff over in with the Bhikkhuni ordination in Thailand 10, 11 years ago. But this is part of life. So that you don't reject anything. You don't blame anybody. You accept this, but behind that, before that, after that, there's always some beauty, some wonderful things to see. And that's actually what we look for. The beauty in the garden. Yeah, there's many dead leaves. Yes, there's many leaves which need to be swept. There's many paving bricks need to be fixed. There's things which need to be watered. It's not perfect, but it never is. But now is the time to appreciate it. Appreciate the people you live with. Appreciate yourself. Appreciate who you are. Appreciate your journey through life, no matter what age you are. When you have that sense of appreciation, kindness to yourself, acceptance, then you have that same kindness and acceptance to all the other people you meet. People may swear at you, you can smile back, a real one, You know those real smiles, they're powerful. I don't mean just being superior or being sort of arrogant or playing around. When you really appreciate the pain in other people and their laughter, and accept both, and you accept and live with, grow with, and make a beautiful world. And then sometimes these so-called lockdowns, self-isolation, whatever you call it, sometimes you say, thank you so much, please give me more. I learn so much. I grow so much. I learn to be at peace with myself and love the people I live with. Thank you all for listening. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Yeah, those Ajahn Brahm's three sadhus. Okay, so now we have the this little machine here, which has all the questions from many places. First of all, we have a question from the Easter Bunny. Okay, I think you have a message of permission from Mark McGowan. He's a Premier of Western Australia, held by the Easter Bunny. Special exemption, but I deserve that because I do worse. For travel into and within Western Australia, I, Mark McGowan, Premier of Western Australia, hereby authorise the Easter Bunny, this fellow, hello Easter Bunny, to travel to Western Australia for the essential service of egg delivery, signed, Mark McGowan. So you got that, did you? From Mr. Mark McGowan, official signature. The Premier of Western Australia. Just, you know, sometimes people say, oh, that's so childish. We want to hear the Dhamma. This is the Dhamma of kindness for all beings, for children. They learn so much love and kindness. Little pieces of chocolate and an Easter bunny. I don't know why a white bunny can lay brown chocolate, but who knows why. Anyway, the question from USA, what is the best Buddhist way to rebuild lives, find jobs to make enough money to live well, as well as donate to the poor and the sick, because of poverty is a cause of suffering? Sometimes you ask a question about poverty. How much money do you need? What do you actually need? What is poverty? And a helpful way in the Buddhist tradition, especially the monastic tradition for monks and nuns, we have what's called the four basic requisites, the four essential parts of living, which, you know, is supposed to allow us to live peacefully as Buddhist monks or Buddhist nuns. It's a very simple thing. It's just like food for the belly and robes to, you know, to cover us, keep us warm, keep us out of harm. A place to stay at night, small room, or like me, a cave. 68 years of age now, and I still sleep on the floor. It's much easier. It means I never get out of the wrong side of the bed in the morning, because I don't have a bed. I just have a mattress. And isn't that true? And so I have a place to stay, I have robes, I have food, and I'm on medicine in times of sickness. And it's such a long time since I've really been sick. I had a cough. Well, that didn't stop me teaching, and just, it was an irritation, not a sort of a disease as far as I was concerned. But anyway, so how Buddhists rebuild lives, find jobs to make enough money to live well. Live well. What do you mean by live well? What is living well? I live well. I think most people would agree that I live well. I have a nice fat belly. I have food, sometimes food which I like, sometimes food which I don't like, but eat it and
see what happens. And I have the requisites. So to me, that's living well. I don't need a big house. A big house is not for you. A big house is just to impress others. Say you've made it in this world. I think I've pretty much made it as a good monk. A nice big monastery, lots of really good friends. So to rebuild lives, find jobs. I don't know that sometimes that when there are these pandemics, these world-changing crises, sometimes it does allow us to think better and even challenge what was living well. The person who's made it. Look at me, I've got no money at all, I've got no superannuation, no way of retiring, no pension fund, no car, no house, and even the cave in which I live. Somebody could take that over tomorrow, I don't know, maybe when I go back to the monastery that another monk's taken over, there's been a revolution, there's a new abbot abiding in the monastery, I don't know. Very unlikely, but it's... So how can we do this? It's actually learning how to live with less, living smaller accommodation, being able to live with others. So we don't fight, we don't just need our own rooms. So that means that we can have more peace in this world with using less. So that people don't have poverty. Enough food to eat. Maybe, because people always say there's too many human beings around. So maybe if more people became monks and nuns, then that would throw in the population of the world. Do you think I'll get very far with that proposition? I don't know. Anyway. Okay, from Spain. Okay. The USA was going through a lot of hell with the sicknesses and losses and deaths of the coronavirus, but Spain have gone through that and they're still going through it. As a doctor or in general, how can I better help the families to overcome the dual of not having been able to be there with their loved ones before they die? Being there with their loved ones before they die. Now, is that really true? Sometimes, well, I don't know why these stories just pop up into my head, but just round the corner from here, in Nala Way, in Nala Mara, many years ago, there was one of the members of our Buddhist society lived there by himself. And he was English, and he was a ranger, it was Stirlingshire. Yeah. And, or was it Vincent? Anyway, one of the shires, a shire ranger. A very down-to-earth man. And, he told me that one morning, well, actually not one morning, middle of the night, in his house, living there by himself, he woke up, middle of the night, knowing that something was strange. He turned on his light next to his bed and saw his mother standing at the end of his bed. Clear as if it was his mother had got on a plane and came to visit him. But he knew it couldn't be his physical mother, because his mother was sick in hospital. And it was clear as ever could be. She was standing at the end of his bed. I don't know why the end of his bed, but that's where she was standing, looking at him with only the smile of love which a mother can give to her children. Beautiful smile. He told me this lasted about 6 or 7 minutes, somewhere around that, not just a flash, but a long time. Never long enough, but it was long. And he just drank in, soaked in, just took in as much of that loving smile as he possibly could. He knew it was a ghost. It's the only time he's ever seen a ghost, a real ghost, a real spirit. But it was a beautiful, he just valued that experience so much. And then
he couldn't say anything. He was just smiling back, knowing that if she was appearing so clear in front of the whole body, just not just the wisp or something which he interpreted, no, see, it was just like his real mother was standing there. And she knew she must have died. But the beauty of the visit, the gratitude, feeling how lucky he was to have seen her for one last time, took away any fear or disappointment. And after that time had gone, he just couldn't move, just smiling back, seeing his mother for the last time. Then she disappeared. And of course, being English, he got up and put on the kettle and made himself a cup of tea. I don't know why English people do that. But any emergency, any problem, what should I do next? Have a cup of tea. Even to the point that when Ajahn Chah went over to UK, and I asked him, said, did you learn any English? I asked him in Thai, in Laotian actually. And he said, yeah. What did you learn? Because he went to England for a while, and the United States. The only word which he remembered from that trip was cup of tea. Cup of tea was all he remembered. He must have heard it so many times, it stuck in his head. But anyway, he got up, and as he was having his cup of tea, this fellow just around the corner here, sister rang up, Pete, I've got some bad news for you. Yeah, I know, Mum's dead. What? How do you know? And he said it with such calmness, with such reassurance, because she's just been visiting me for about 6 or 7 minutes. How blessed is that? So, he wasn't with her when she died. But he had the openness to have a visit after she died. What a beautiful thing that was. So, the family's overcome, not having been able to be there with the loved ones before they die. They can be with their loved ones after they die. Even just sitting in front of a picture, by yourself, closing your eyes, and just feeling, if you need to reimagine the loved one, just open your eyes and then close them again. And imagine all the beautiful times you've spent together. Imagine all the gifts which your loved one has given you. The laughter, the friendship, the tears as well, the disappointments, the arguments, that's part of a relationship. Those wonderful times you spent together. And you say, thank you so much. Even with the memory, you're with them again. Or as this story which I do tell at funerals. I think this works in Spain. If you're that age, you remember the time when people would go from country to country, not in aircraft, but in passenger liners. Not in these cruise ships, but the whole job of the passenger liners to take you from one port to another point when you're travelling overseas. And anyway, the story of you take your loved one to the ship, to the port, and they get on to the boat, and you're down there on the dock, they're up there on the ship waving to you as the ship sounds its whistle or horn and then starts to sail away. And that's your loved one is going. And you're down on the dock, and you're waving at them as they go further and further away, until the boat is far enough away you can't distinguish your loved one from all the other passengers on that boat. Because when people leave in death, they don't leave just your relation. Many other people's loved ones are also on that boat. As it goes further and further away, that grey mass of people, one of which is your loved one, gets almost invisible
as all you can now see is the boat carrying it away. And you still stand watching that vessel in which your loved one is somewhere. You watch it and watch it and watch it until it gets so far away it passes over this line called the horizon. When it goes to the other side of the horizon, you can't see it anymore. To you, it's beyond your sight. But you know they haven't disappeared. They're just out of reach, out of sight, out of touch, out of contact. That's all. But sometimes you can feel them. They're still there somewhere. Maybe to meet together another time, another place. But people don't just disappear and vanish. It's something which is always left. Understand what a person is. Not just their old body, or their young body, or their sick body. Because the COVID virus takes all ages, all types of people. But they haven't really gone. It's the memories, experiences, the gratitude, and even more than that, always remains. I often say my father died over 50 years ago. How many years? 16. Yeah, 52 years ago. But I can still remember him. He still lives in my heart in a very real way. So that's actually how you say, that's how you can be there with their loved ones before they die, after they're dead. It's just at that time for your own health and those last little medications, because they're contagious. You can't be there at that time, but afterwards you can be with them. I don't mean with the body, I mean with them. Okay. Last question from dot dot dot. In other words, they're not saying, I want to quit my job so that I will be able to develop mindfulness, but I'm afraid it means going without a regular salary and living on savings. Please advise. This particular time, just, you know, the jobs, this world is changing so much during the COVID-19 time. But if you develop mindfulness, not just mindfulness, kindfulness. If it's just mindfulness, again, mindfulness is a bit too cold. And the Buddha didn't teach mindfulness. He taught a whole band of things. So just don't just have, you know, one little part of the meal. Just have the whole 8-course meal. So this means that you have more than mindfulness. Kindness, service, peace, wisdom, a whole lot. And then, going without a regular salary and living on savings. Savings can go pretty quickly. You know, there's always some sort of jobs and service you can do in life. There's many sort of little jobs. And if you don't need much, but you really just want to give, sometimes that people find these amazing jobs in life. They don't get much money, but they get enough to survive. At the same time, they can live a beautiful life. It's like some of the people living in our Buddhist society here. Very fortunate caretakers and stuff. Get a nice place to stay. And they can develop mindfulness. Live a simple life. You know, when, you know, the COVID crisis is over and lots of people come and visit, you don't need to get any food. You know, you're just... the leftovers here are just, whoa, huge. So there's many advantages. And so just wait and see what can happen. Never give up. But don't just do mindfulness practice, kindfulness. The wisdom, the deep teachings. It's much more important than anything else. Okay, so I've gone a few minutes over time. Please forgive me if I've taken up your time. I wish you all happiness and well-being. I don't know, I'm going to do this because somebody from Indonesia asked me that when I was in Indonesia last February or whatever, that at the end of the talks which I gave in Medan, I would give a little chant. If I remember correctly, it's a Chula Mangala Sutta. It was a very simple chant, but a very nice. And it's actually the short version, which is what I did in Indonesia. And this is from the gentleman from Medan who asked me. Sabaroga Vinimuto Sabasantapa Vajito Sabavera Mati Gando Nibuto Jato Wangbawa Sabitio Viva Chantu Sabarogo Vinasatu Mate Bhavan Vantarayo Sukhiti Gayu Gopava Apivadan Hasilitsa Nichang Uttapachalino Chataro Dhamma Vatanti Ayuvano Sukhang Balan. Happy Easter, everybody. Happy New Year for the South Asians and Southeast Asians. For Bhajan Brahm and also the Easter Bunny. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Good night, everyone. Oh. Okay.